KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Pueblo architects continue to respond to modern Western influences like HUD housing and local building codes by embracing familiar tribal aesthetics and design features. A new exhibit at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque traces Pueblo knowledge from the earliest dwellings to homes and other structures being built today. Restoring Our Heart Places tells the story of how Pueblo people are reasserting what they've always known about architecture. We'll talk with the curators after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's a double-wide trailer off the Birchwood exit on the outskirts of Anchorage, Alaska. Not exactly a Las Vegas-style casino, but since the Acluna Tribe's new gaming hall opened in January, there are often long lines of people waiting to get in. That could change if the state is successful in its bid to shut down the gambling operation. On Wednesday, the Alaska Attorney General asked a federal court in Washington, D.C. to issue a preliminary injunction against it. This follows a lawsuit the state filed in February after the Interior Department approved the project in the final days of the Biden administration. The Chenon Gaming Hall sits on a Native allotment near the Birchwood Airport. The Interior Department under Biden said the Acluna Tribe has sovereignty over the land, just as tribes in the lower 48 have over reservations where gaming is allowed. But the state is fighting that decision based on previous court cases that gave the state jurisdiction over Native allotments. Aaron Leggett, president of the Acluna Tribe, called the latest court filing disheartening, a sign that Governor Mike Dunleavy is escalating his attack on tribal sovereignty. In a statement, he touted the success of the casino and its potential to bring jobs and economic opportunity to the region. The gaming hall is in a temporary building with fewer than 100 electronic bingo games. The tribe plans to expand to a larger facility with more machines and restaurants. Minnesota's unemployment rate is low, but the state still faces a skilled labor shortage. A regional college hopes to be a solution as it looks to break ground on a new training center for in-demand jobs. Data shows Minnesota has a job vacancy rate of more than 5%. That's above the desired goal of around 4%, with the older population leaving the workforce. At White Earth Tribal and Community College, school president Anna Shepherd says not having a big enough talent pool for certain job types is a problem in her part of the state.
You know, we've had to wait for electricians to come in, just do work here, just because there's not money in this area.
The school is planning a trades building on campus to develop the next generation of plumbers, electricians, and other skilled workers. It could also benefit White Earth's plan to expand its renewable energy programming for students. The project's cost is $15 million. Supporters hope the state will chip in, but a tighter spending mood in the legislature, along with the impact of federal cuts, could make that difficult. White Earth Student Senate President Deidre Berg sees this planned building as a way to keep Indigenous students post-graduation in surrounding communities that struggle with limited wages and a lack of resources.
We are a food desert area, and so that's like a really big issue here. We'd like to be able to offer our people, our students, the tools to get their education here and hopefully stay close to home and build our community up.
The organization Fresh Energy says training students for projects like solar power development can help local economies get stronger. Campus officials say they've already secured land for the trades building and the architectural renderings are complete. If state aid is slow, White Earth will try to line up grants and other support. Training could begin as early as fall of 2027. An Indian mascot bill has passed the Illinois House of Representatives. WIFR reports the legislation prohibits K-12 schools in the state from using a Native American name, logo, or mascot. It passed by a vote of 71-40. If signed into law, schools will have until 2026 to make changes. The bill now heads to the Senate. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance. With offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska, Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support provided by First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach to meet the financial needs of Alaskans by providing banking services, loans, investments, and more to help shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fmbalaska.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. From Mesa Verde to Chaco Canyon to present-day homes and tribal buildings, Pueblo architecture has stood the test of both time and colonial pressures. A new exhibit at the Inden Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque explores that timeline to focus on contemporary design that is still conducive to culture and community. Restoring our heart places starts with the cultural connections in a T-shaped door design. The exhibit explores aesthetics, land, building materials, city planning, self-determination, and the future. In this hour, we'll talk with the exhibit's curators and contributors to learn more about contemporary Pueblo architecture. And we welcome you to the conversation. What are the features of indigenous design in your community? How do buildings and spaces in your area align with your cultural aesthetics? How do all these concepts enhance the overall well-being of people and communities? Let us know by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's now meet today's guests. Joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico is Dr. Theodore Hohola. He is a co-curator of the exhibit and founder of the Indigenous Design and Planning Institute at the University of New Mexico. He is Isleta Pueblo. Dr. Hohola, hello and welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to have you back.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. I'm really happy to be back on the program again.
Joining us from Santa Fe, New Mexico is Dr. Lynn Paxson. She is also a co-curator of the exhibit, and she is Emeritus University Professor and a Professor of Architecture in the College of Design at Iowa State University and an affiliate of the Indigenous Design and Planning Institute at the University of New Mexico. Dr. Paxson, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much.
Joining us from Santa Fe, New Mexico is Brian Vio. He is a former governor of Acoma Pueblo, an independent consultant, a board member for the Inden Pueblo Cultural Center, and an advisor on this exhibit. Brian, hello. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, everyone. Yeah, thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Hey, it's great to have you on the show, Brian. Really appreciate you coming back. And our fourth guest joins us from Albuquerque, New Mexico, Sherelle Brown. She is an advisory board member for the exhibit. She's also an intern architect with Woven Architecture and a grad student in the Master's of Architecture program at the University of New Mexico. She's also working toward a certificate in historic preservation and regionalism. She is Santo Domingo Pueblo. Sherelle, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on as well.
Thank you, everyone. It's good to be on this conversation, and I'm looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it as well. And Dr. Hohola, I want to begin with you. What sparked this idea to curate an exhibit that focuses specifically on Pueblo architecture?
Well, actually, the germination of this whole concept occurred in 2004, and it was really the result of the dedication of the new School of Architecture and Planning building here at the University of New Mexico. And at that time, there was an exhibit that was concurrent with its opening that was sponsored by the American Institute of Architects called the 150 Most Endeared Buildings in the United States. So I immediately rushed up to the exhibit hall, was all excited to see what was there. And guess what? There was no example of Native architecture in that exhibit. It was all colonial, Buddhist, whatever, but no Native representation at all.
Mm. All right, so I can understand how that fired you up, Dr. Hola. The title, Restoring, what is it, exactly does that mean? That's an interesting word to use.
Well, it's come into common usage just actually within a short period of time, but it's basically applying new stories, or certainly, you know, one of the tenets of the Indigenous Design and Planning Institute is we need no translators. So restoring is essentially the ability to go and take what is commonly known from somebody's other's voice and usurp that and return it back to our own voice.
Now tell us, how is this exhibit from other exhibits that you've worked on in the past?
Well, many of the kinds of exhibits that you tend to see in terms of architectural presentations are what we call eye candy exhibits. That is, they basically show this sort of spectacular aspects of the architecture, but really in a very two-dimensional way. Beautiful glossy pictures, lots of decoration, interior shots, so on and so forth. But really, they're intended in order to sort of showcase the person and the or the architect who was the basic designer behind it. This one is much, much different in the sense of the fact that it's really driven by the kind of policy that has impacted our communities, beginning with the Indian self-determination in 1975. In fact, actually, we're celebrating the 50th year of that landmark legislation. And using that as kind of the time frame for determining when contemporary Pueblo architecture comes into play. So the idea behind it is then, with all the consequent other major types of legislation, all the way from the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act to the Native American Graves Repatriation Act, Indian Education Act, and other major things, what have been actually the kind of reactions by our own people, especially those that are architects and designers, to bring that notion of culture and identity, as well as the functionality of what it is that our architecture has developed and evolved in response to all these new programs that mushroom out of that whole sense of self-determination.
Now, I know you refer to any type of Pueblo architecture post Self-Determination Act 1975 as contemporary, but of course, as we all know, Pueblo history dates back thousands of years. How much of that early history, I'm thinking of early colonial influence, both before the Spanish arrived and even during that era when the Spanish and the Pueblo people lived and sometimes fought around the same time, how much of that is included as well?
Well, that's why, in a sense, we essentially grounded in this notion of restoring, because too often, I think, you know, Pueblo architecture has really been typecast into the ancient mode, and a lot of people don't realize that we've been innovating on that. But what we've been really fortunate to have in terms of our community is that foundation of all that spirituality and all that sense of being an identity and place knowing that, in a sense, has really capitulated how it is that we continue to represent ourselves to this day. And it's been such a major influence that not only is it represented within our own communities, but it's also represented in the whole of the Southwest. When people talk about Southwest architecture, they're not talking necessarily about Hispano or certainly not Anglo. A lot of that is really influenced by Pueblo architecture. But what I think this show brings to bear is the fact that we, as our own people, have also been innovating on that. And rightfully, it's our matrimony from that standpoint. It's what it is that we're carrying forth from our ancestors in what we call the seven generations planning.
Dr. Hoholo, there's a Native scholar by the name of Stephen Wall. He wrote a great book titled American Indian Tribal Governance. And in that book, I learned, and I should have probably already known this, but I learned from Stephen Wall that there were 88 Pueblos at the time of Spanish settlement in the late 1500s. Click ahead to today, we have 19 federally recognized Pueblo tribes in New Mexico, plus, of course, the Hopi in Arizona, and then the Isleta del Sur in Texas. Can you look at these 21 different Pueblo communities and point to any specific architectural features or traits that different Pueblos have?
Well, a lot of them are attuned to building and respecting the earth. So the building materiality is one of the aspects of this. We still have in our communities buildings that are made from stone and adobe and toroni, for example. And in a sense, it creates this beautiful kind of form that you don't see represented anywhere else in the United States. It's got this very textural form. It's not angular. It's smooth. And often when you look at it from the sort of ancestral standpoint, those people who practice traditionally in doing this kind of building use their hands. And of course, the other aspect of this is that we believe that the buildings themselves have lives and life cycles just like ours. So they're built from the earth and they serve their useful purpose. And if they're done, then they return to the earth. So I think all of these are really important kind of conceptual things that go into the thinking about how it is that we build that relationship to our places.
Dr. Hoholo, thank you for kicking off our discussion today on Native America Calling. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and continue this conversation. We have other guests on the show as well who are either curators of this exhibit or involved with it or experts on Pueblo architecture, contemporary Pueblo architecture. That's primarily the focus of our show today. And I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. Maybe you're someone who lives in a contemporary Pueblo home. Maybe you're in one of the villages right now and you're listening to the show. Maybe you grew up in a contemporary Pueblo home. Maybe you grew up in one of the older adobe homes there on one of the plazas in one of the Pueblos, or maybe even grew up in a HUD home. I don't know. But if you've got any thoughts or any insights with regard to what Pueblo architecture means to you, what our buildings, what our communities, what this culture all represents in the form of architecture, sure like to have you join the conversation. And you can do that by calling 1-800-99-NATIVE. Phone lines are open. We're waiting for your call. So what are you waiting for? Let's talk. 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Waves of federal funding and staff cuts by the Trump administration are beginning to affect services and programs that many Native Americans rely on. Innovative community resources like libraries, museums, heating aid, and early child care are among those on the chopping block. We'll get an update on the next NAC.
My name is Tammy, and I'm a member of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians. Smoking gave me heart disease. I used to think of cigarette smoking as something that only affected me. Then at just 44 years old, I had to look into my mom's eyes on the way into emergency heart surgery and tell her, "Mommy, I promise I won't make you bury me." My tip is, think about the people in your life who love you. They go through the pain too, maybe even more than you do.
The people you love are worth quitting for. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the CDC.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. We're talking about Pueblo architecture today, and you can join this conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. Let's now speak with Dr. Lynn Paxson, who is also a co-curator of this new exhibit at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque. And Dr. Paxson, I'm a big fan of the old Shakespeare quote, "What's past is prologue." What elements did you want to see in this exhibit to reflect the future of indigenous architecture?
Well, I would reinforce something that Ted said, that it's really about understanding that these are places that are alive, the land matters, and the people matter. So not only do the stories matter, but in most mainstream architecture, a building is made and it's considered finished, which is not true for indigenous and Pueblo architecture. This is a living item that changes over time and supports Pueblo communities and Pueblo people. And we wanted to reinforce that and to include the stories from, you know, a broad range of perspectives, you know, kids through elders, tribal administrators, regular folks and people who are continuing to build. So that's really important, and we really wanted to underscore those kind of issues in what people were seeing. Plus, another thing I wanted to see in the exhibit was, you know, we want to get more indigenous folks into the design field, and you kind of need to know what people do in order to see this as a possibility for you in the future. So it's about opening up the pipeline more and letting indigenous people know, especially young people know, that you don't have to be like, you know, this math whiz and an engineer. You can be a really good designer in a lot of different kinds of ways. So we want folks to see that and to see it for the future for themselves. And we want people who are not Pueblo to understand that this exists, and that architecture students from all over the country should know about this as much as they know about Egyptian architecture, or you know architecture that happened during the Renaissance and so on and so forth. So since most indigenous architects are a little bit humble and don't worry about getting, well, they don't get published anyway, but you know, this would get their word out so that people would know. You know, people always think to me, oh, there are indigenous architects? ? Like, of course there are.
Dr. Paxson, one of the challenges of a radio show when talking about an exhibit like this is we can share some of these images online, but we can't show them to our listeners right now. But tell us more about some of your favorite elements and examples of contemporary architecture that are included in this exhibit.
Well, I'm a huge fan of the Isleta Head Start by Janet Carpio. I mean, this building was done by someone who started as a thesis student and saw it as important, and made a building that reflects Isleta cultural practices and the understanding of the community and the education, and, you know, making this great place that is like a home for kids when they're little and they leave home. And I have to tell you, you know, I've been in a lot of architecture buildings that are 20 years old, and I have never, and I underscore never, seen a building that's so well cared for. I mean, everything, they like keep everything totally fabulous. It's totally clean. It's totally updated. It's like, it looks like it was done yesterday, not 20 years ago. And that's a huge, huge comment on the quality of a living building, because it means the community cares, which means they feel like the architect did what they needed. So that's one of my favorite buildings. There's some great housing from Wadi to other places. There's some preservation of the plaza housing and lots of different pueblos. And I mean, Lou Weller's Clinic for the Taos and the Picaris. It's actually won awards because Lou was kind of better well-known because of working on the National Museum of the American Indian for the Smithsonian. So, you know, there's some work like that, but, you know, the great work at Pauke. I mean, it's really amazing the stuff that we found.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at some of the images online. Not only are there great photos, but there are scale models that were developed by architects. There's a lot of just text explaining what some of these design elements are. It all looks really fantastic. And I also want to talk about one of the examples that's featured. It is the Sky City Cultural Center, Acoma Pueblo. And to do that, let's bring Brian Vio into the conversation, of course, former governor of Acoma Pueblo and an advisor on the exhibit. Brian, you had a hand in designing the Sky City Cultural Center. What were some important cultural elements that this building needed to have?
Yeah, thanks for that question. And, you know, there's a lot to be said, but, you know, this building, the Cultural Center and Museum, really is a result of a significant loss at the Pueblo when we lost our what's called the Tourist Center to a fire, a tragic fire that destroyed the entire building and all of its contents. And so in response to the Tribal Council's directive to rebuild and rebuild as fast as we can, we assembled a committee at the Pueblo of a number of directors and experts and artists to think about, you know, if we are to rebuild and rebuild quickly, what is it that we are going to build? And that discussion led to a consensus that here was an opportunity for the Pueblo to do something a little different and to engage the community in the planning and the design of a new building. And so we did just that. We were successful at obtaining some federal support, funding support, as well as a generous gift from the tribal government or the tribal council to embark on a very aggressive planning initiative. And this included over 40 community-based focus group meetings that generated ideas about what this building would represent. And so we took that information and then developed an RFP for architecture and design services. And eventually hired Barbara Felix Architecture and Design in with Wood Metal Concrete, who collaborated on the design and worked with the Pueblo. So some of the things that came out as a result of these discussions within the community were, you know, we wanted a space that was a welcoming center, a grand home, a house. Because in our culture and most, well, in all of Pueblo culture and Native culture, you know, we're very welcoming people, and our homes are the center of family and community and culture. And so this place that we were envisioning to build needed to represent that, that it was a welcoming space. In addition to that, we learned from the community the importance of incorporating other components, some new components that were not part of the visitor center. And these included classroom spaces for language revitalization initiatives, for the teaching of traditional art forms, and just gathering spaces for the community, for intergenerational learning, for families who might need spaces to convene meetings, meeting spaces for our tribal leaders and our cultural leaders, a theater, collections area, gallery spaces, new restaurant, and, you know, many other things, along with spaces outside on that surround the campus that were also very important to the community. And so the end result of all of this and the design process led to the creation of a 40,000 square foot facility, which sits on the original footprint of the tourist center, which was around 17,000 square feet. But we increased that square footage by creating a basement level and a second floor that includes a research library, office spaces, conference room, and on the lower level being collections and a special place designed for also a welcoming space for items that would be repatriated, cultural patrimony items that would come to the museum, filter through the museum until final disposition was determined by cultural leaders and other tribal leadership. So, yeah, we have this beautiful facility, and it, you know, represents the architectural history of not only Pueblo people, but Acoma people specifically. So we trace our migration from Mesa Verde and Chaco Canyon, the initial villages that were established near Acoma before the ancestors ascended onto the Mesa where we live today, but also tracing that architectural history on the Mesa top. And then the more current history when we migrated back northward and established the small villages that are now are where our larger communities reside today in Acomita, McCarty's, and looking at the types of housing that we see on that landscape, some of which is HUD housing, some of which include modular homes and newer types of construction that have infiltrated into our architectural menu. So all of these elements are represented in the building. It's really quite interesting and just really fascinating to see how through the community voice and these ideas that were generated by children at Head Start to the elders at the Senior Center, you know, brought together this really grand and beautiful concept of what the Sky City Cultural Center and Aku Museum would be. And the tribe is very, very honored to, you know, welcome visitors, but also welcome our community, which was also very, very much a priority for our community members. With that, this was a space for our community people today and into the future.
I've been to the cultural center. It's absolutely breathtaking. I totally agree in that. You keep talking about that welcoming element, making people feel welcome. And I know, Brian, that there's a lot of research, just like the way a space is designed, it can have so much influence in our spiritual health, our mental health, just our total disposition in life can be improved by just being in some sort of an architectural space that's welcoming and makes us feel good. And what do you look for when you go into one of these built, maybe a house there at Acoma, something that's been recently built? Your tribal headquarters there is also a very nice piece of a good example of Pueblo architecture. What do you want to see? What do you want to feel when you walk into one of these buildings there on the Pueblo?
Well, you know, as Ted mentioned earlier, you know, our homes, our buildings all have life. And whether we built it on our own or not, these spaces have life, we believe. And so anytime, you know, we enter a space, we say, Gu'atli, you know, we say hello. Whether someone is in the building or not, we are greeting that space. And we come into that space and know that it's a safe space and that it is likely to offer something good to us while we're within that space. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things about Pueblo culture and Native American culture is that, you know, there's this idea and not idea, but there's this belief that these structures, these places, and spaces have life, that there is something there that is special. And when we leave those spaces, it's also, you know, taking a part of that goodness, right? having been welcomed and protected and, you know, just embraced, really, I think, is something that is really special. And I see that throughout our Pueblo communities and even in the new buildings that are constructed, whether it's housing or community spaces, they're very welcoming. And you get a sense almost immediately that the lifeway of the people is clearly represented, whether it's on the exterior or interior. You get a sense that these places were not drawn up by an architect or an individual for the sake of their benefit and praise, as Lynn referred to earlier, but that these are community-owned spaces. They are important to the community. The community takes pride in these buildings, and they take care of them the best way that they can. And, you know, it's just part of this inherent understanding and responsibility that we take very seriously, that we have an obligation, we have a responsibility to care for these structures just as we do care for one another.
Brian, I want to ask you one more question before we go to break in about another minute. I love everything you're describing. It resonates, I think, very much with our listeners. But at the same time, all of these design elements, all these features, at this, you're bound it's still by building codes, by structural requirements. You still have to make all of this fit into this contemporary regulatory framework. And I know that the Indian Self-Determination Act, you know, that gives a lot of leeway in terms of not just policy, not just how we run services, but also how we can build and how we can create these spaces that you're describing. But just talk for just a moment about what that's like. Again, just bring it all to the contemporary aspect of working with codes and regulations and making sure these buildings are up to standards.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would say that throughout this project, I think it was learning that was occurring on both ends, right? We were learning a lot as a community about process, about Western architecture. We learned a lot about our own history associated with designing and building community spaces. While the architects were also learning from us and learning from our community, learning from our leaders about what was important, what is important when you're thinking about design and construction of a space for community and for the outside.
Thank you so much, Brian. Really appreciate your time. We're going to take a short break and we will be right back.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show. This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. Through service with AmeriCorps Vista, you gain valuable professional experience and leadership skills while helping organizations in your community alleviate poverty. Find a service opportunity at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. Are you or someone you care about looking to take their education to the next level? Native Forward Scholars Fund is here to help. With awards up to $30,000, Native Forward Scholars Fund is dedicated to supporting Native students as they pursue higher education. With Native Forward Scholarships, you can overcome financial barriers and open doors to a world of opportunities. Native Forward Scholars Fund, working to build a brighter future and empower Native students one scholarship at a time. Info and applications at nativeforward.org, who support this show. Support by Alaska Growth Capital. The Bristol Bay Marketplace is now open. Bristol Bay Native Corporation shareholders, descendants, and spouses are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace. Skuktash.
For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nye.
This is Native America Calling. There's still time to join today's conversation about Pueblo architecture. Tell us how important is indigenous design and infrastructure in your community. You can share your insights and perspectives by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's now hear from Sherelle Brown. She is an advisory board member for the exhibit. She's also a graduate student in the Masters of Architecture program at the University of New Mexico. And Sherelle, hello again. Thank you for joining the show. And you've got an Adobe form that's on display in the exhibit. And you're also featured at the end, along with some other up-and-coming young architects and artists, as a representation of the future. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the Adobe form is part of a little bit of an experimentation that I was working through. So the form is made to the size of the Adobes needed to restore my grandmother's village house, which was built in the late 1800s. And so we assess the house, and the size of the Adobes within the house are 24 by 12 by 4 inches. And so part of the restoration process for it meant that we needed to replace the Adobes to the same size in order to restitch the walls properly and stabilize them. And so I have been making Adobes for a while now, and part of that process, or the traditional process, I guess, is using a wooden form. And so you press the mud into the wooden form and then immediately pull the wooden form upward. And every single time you do that, the mud sticks to the sides of the forms, and you need to rinse the form and then use it again. And so I had been working with Francisco Avina, who is a mentor and a professor of mine, as well as the co-facilitator for the restoration project of my grandma's village house. And he brought in a small Adobe form that was used for a class that a student of his made. And it was an acrylic form. And Francisco told me, you know, if you use this form, the mud doesn't stick to the walls. And I thought, that's so interesting. I bet I could do that for the village house. And so thankfully, Woven Architecture had a bunch of extra acrylic laying around, and they gave it to me, and I took it to the fabrication lab at the School of Architecture and just started experimenting. And my mom and little brother, they've been involved in the project from the beginning. They paint pottery, and so they showed me a pot of theirs, and it was a very traditional Santo Domingo Pueblo design, a design that you can see in many of our pots. Not just the ones that my mom and little brother make, but other people in the community. And my little brother said, I can draw it for you, or I can sketch it for you, and you can trace it. And wouldn't it be cool to use it somehow, he told me. And at that point, I was like, you know, this would be so cool on the Adobe form. And so I laser cut it in the fabrication lab, and that design wraps around the entire form for the Adobe. Their acrylic form. And so sure enough, the form worked out really well, and we used it that summer at my family's ranch, and it works like a dream. You can put in all the mud and pull the form out, and mud doesn't stick anywhere. And these are massive Adobes. They are three times the size of standard Adobes today. And so it felt like a fun way to really innovate the way that we make Adobes. Even though it's like such a small thing, it does cut down a lot on the time that it takes to make an Adobe.
This is so cool, Sherelle. You know what really excites me? So I think for a lot of people that might come to New Mexico or travel through some of the Pueblos, and they'll see you know, you go through town, right? You go to Albuquerque, especially in Santa Fe, you have all, you know, they have codes that all the buildings need to look kind of like this Pueblo revival style with vigas mm-hmm. and everything stucco. But what's so kind of crazy about that is if you go up and if you were to just scrape away that stucco, there's not a brick of adobe in there. It's all stick built, right? It's all frame.
Right.
And it's not just what it looks like on the outside. It's what's on the inside. It's the heart of it, the structure, the framing. And that's the traditional way using adobe, which you're doing. So, no, that's just super, super cool. And but I know it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to make those bricks. And are there a lot of people still there at San Domingo that are building with adobe and using these techniques that you've worked on?
I would say that a lot of the adobes that are made today are mostly used for orno making. Or the outdoor ovens. What we're seeing today is our community is actually rebuilding with compressed earth block, which is not at all the same as adobe, and it functions a lot differently. So a lot of what our project is trying to do is remind people about the materiality of the spaces. And I know we talk a lot about this whole exhibit is about contemporary Pueblo architecture, but a lot of what that means for me is really just like paying attention to the materiality of stuff and finding ways to innovate using what we already know really well. And it's also reminding people about how our buildings are made and finding a nice balance between what is quote unquote modern, because what is modern today or what's existing in our houses today might be seen as older, but at one point was modern to our communities. So there are a lot of ways that we can make our homes or our spaces a little bit more contemporary, but feel like our community. They are like the material originates from our land and the places that we know and have grown up around. But adobe is such a fun way to bring everyone together, and it is a lot of hard work. And it's important to remember that traditionally adobes were made by a lot of people. Many people were making them. It wasn't just one family at a time. It was a whole section of the community. And in order to bring I feel like to make a project successful today, whether it's contemporary or a historic project, it really needs to lean on the community in that way. Mm-hmm. The community needs to see themselves in the project, and that can take so many different routes and different forms. And it really is specific to the space and the house and the landscape. Earlier, you had asked Ted, Dr. Hohola, about specific architectural elements, and although we're all Pueblo, and this exhibit is all Pueblo people, there are so many different specific elements in each community that would not belong in another community. Designing for a house in Laguna or designing for a house in Acoma will take a very different shape than designing for a house or a space in Santo Domingo. And I think that could not be more beautiful, spending time really learning about what the space and community needs.
Cheryl, you know what else is fascinating about this conversation, and it's really resonating speaking with you, is that when we think of Pueblo housing and like you're working on adobe, I mean, you can look, there's multiple different types of housing. If somebody goes and visits a Pueblo today, they will see housing, very old housing that dates back over 100 years built with adobe. And then you see houses that were built like during the old 37 Act housing programs. And then you see more contemporary homes that were built during the HUD era and now the NAHASDA era. And you can almost look at our houses and you can draw a timeline of like federal policy in Indian country and how it's kind of played out. And I know that you grew up in your grandparents' HUD house. And, you know, sometimes people kind of knock HUD houses now, that kind of period of architecture and the policy that was involved there. But talk a little bit about that, what that was like growing up in a HUD house, and now the types of houses that you envision for the future and the types of houses that are possible with the adobes that you're making.
Yeah, so I did grow up in my grandfather's head house, and early on I was super, I knew they were completely different spaces, so I understood my grandfather's head house, and then we would spend a lot of time in other spaces in the community, on my grandma's side, on my grandpa's side as well, and those houses were traditional homes. They were built very early on, after several floods within our community. But for me, I was observing the uses of the spaces. Why we would have a baby shower in the village house versus at the HUD house. And I just realized that there's so much flexibility within our village houses. They meet our needs in so many different ways, and it's never specific to one feast day or never specific to one time of the year. There is so much, there are so many different uses for the space, and they, and I felt like that was not present in the HUD housing. It felt like the HUD housing that I was in, you know, we did spend a lot of family time together, but when really important things were happening, we would go to the village. And so today, working with the Adobe and restoring another village house, my grandmother's village house, it really is about returning and in the same light of restoring, really. It's reminding our family about the story and the history of the place, of the home, but also showing a lot of our community what's possible when you restore a home instead of demolishing, which is happening right now. There's a lot of homes being demolished. It's a moment to just sort of pause and remind ourselves of what we know and what our what we know, and then also just to listen to the house and the space and ask it what it needs, ask it how it wants to be better. And that sounds like a funny thing to explain, but my mom has told me time and time again, as she's visited the house over its restoration, she tells me the house is happier. You can feel the house being happier. And I think that is such a beautiful idea. And if we can spend more time listening to our spaces, listening to the land, listening to wherever we're designing a new project for, there's already something there. We need to spend time with it in order for that to allow us to move forward with our design and our ideas. And we're going to constantly learn from that, even when the building is completely finished. And so I am really envisioning, first and foremost, just more housing in our communities. I know that so many of our community members, myself included, spend time in Albuquerque or Santa Fe, and I know there's a housing shortage everywhere, but we have the ability to rebuild for our community or build new spaces or restore new spaces that allow us to fully participate in our community and any cultural events. And again, I think part of that really needs to lean on making the space functional for the entire year.
Cheryl, right on. This is just great. Really appreciate. You're an inspiration, and I just look forward to everything that you're going to accomplish and all the great projects that you'll work on and just the contributions that you're going to make, not only to your people there in San Domingo, but all over Pueblo country and Indian country for that matter. So just keep up the great work, okay?
Thank you.
You bet. Dr. Ted Hohola, I'd like to go back to you as we begin to wind down the show and restoring our heart places. Tell us more about the best way for people to come visit the exhibit, what types of speakers you're going to have, where they can get more information online, perhaps. What do they need to know?
The exhibit will be up until the end of December. And it essentially is packaged in a way that has lots of elements that will want to make you come back over and over again, because it's a complex story, and each section has a lot of detail that's attended to it. But we also have fun things there. We have an immersive theater that is basically a LIDAR-based in the round projection of the Haku Museum itself, and you get to actually be able to visit places within the building and hear from individuals like Brian and museum staff and the architect and others about what is it that you're looking at and what is the meaning of it. And it's absolutely stunning. It's in 8K resolution, so it's pretty immersive. We just also launched today, actually, the animation that exists in the main introductory room, and this is basically a story of migration, an animation created by a very talented Cherokee animator by the name of Joseph Erb, and that's also there that explains that original question of, you know, what is the foundation of where it is that we built our beliefs and how we manifested that into design. And then we have some elements there like actual tools. We have for the first time ever displayed a plumb bob. And if anybody doesn't know what that is, look it up. But it's basically the device that's used to make a wall vertical.
Still used today.
Yes, still used today. And that's the point. But the plumb bob that we have there that has never been seen before is over 800 years old and was excavated at Bandelier. So, I mean, just think of the meaning and importance of that in terms of what our ancestors were doing. So, yeah, there's just so much in a speaker series that's funded by the New Mexico Humanities Council. Just contact Indian Pueblo Cultural Center, and they'll have a lot of that information on you.
All right. All right. We're going to have to wrap up the show. Big thanks to our guests today, Dr. Ted Hajola, Dr. Lynn Paxson, Brian Vio, and Sherelle Brown. Join us next week for another lineup of conversations about Indigenous issues and topics. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our producers are Andy Murphy and Sol Traverso. Joe Thompson is the UNM Local News Fellow. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Sho McPolin is the digital producer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our Chief Operations Officer. The President and CEO of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. Have a safe weekend. I'm Sean Spruce.
Trickster Cultural Center hosts the 11th Annual National Gathering of American Indian Veterans to honor veterans and military personnel of all cultures, eras, and branches in a native way. Trickster Cultural Center's National Gathering of American Indian Veterans is open to the public at no charge Friday, July 18th and Saturday, July 19th in Schaumburg, Illinois. More at tricksterculturalcenter.org/national-gathering-2025. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.